Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I'm sorry for that technical difficulty, but we are back on air now. Welcome to another episode of Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I'm your host, Maria Wall. And as always, tonight we have another dynamic guest for you. Tonight we have, as our special guest, Ms. Vicki Kind. Ms. Kind is a clinical bioethicist, medical educator, and hospice volunteer. She is a renowned lecturer, inspiring healthcare professionals throughout the United States to have integrity and compassion. And she also teaches them techniques to improve communication about the end of life care. With that said, Vicki? Hello? We are still experiencing technical difficulties here. Give me one moment. We'll be right back with you on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. Hello, Vicki. Are you there?
Yes. I don't know why that phone line wasn't working. I tried a second one, and then that worked. So, sorry.
the switchboard is going crazy. So, hello.
No problem. Yes,
oh, great.
I'm on here with you, and I'm good to go. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We all rely on technical issues for everything nowadays.
Yeah. Yes, and I'll have to have a talk with them because the switchboard was going crazy. But again, for our listeners who are just joining us, we did experience some technical difficulties with our switchboard at the beginning of our show. So once again, I'd like to welcome you to Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And if you missed our beginning of our show, again, our special guest this week is Ms. Vicki Kind. Ms. Kind is a clinical bioethicist, medical educator, and hospice volunteer. She's a renowned lecturer inspiring healthcare professionals throughout the United States to have integrity and compassion, and she teaches them techniques to improve communication about the end-of-life care. We have lost Vicki again. Vicki, are you back?
Yes. Hi there.
Okay, great.
We'll just be patient with each other, and listeners, just hold on. We'll get this sorted out.
We will, because it's the people on the switchboard, all the callers have disappeared. But we're going to get the show started because welcome to our guest in our chat room. We are experiencing technical difficulties of a major proportion this evening. For all of our callers, please call back. Our number is 646-478-4726. Again, this is Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And I'm your host, Maria Wall, and I'm here with Miss Dickie Kine. And she is the author of the book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. And I wanted to just let the listeners know that this is a topic that so many of us either shy away from, or for whatever reason, we are not prepared to talk about. If a loved one gets ill or becomes incapacitated to the point where they can no longer speak for themselves or represent themselves, sometimes we have to take the role of the decision maker, and sometimes we have to make some very, very hard decisions. And with that said, of course, Vicki, when we had first started conversing about you being a guest, One of the people that had come to mind for me was a close family member who had posed the question or had a dilemma where one of the parents pretty much said, you know, that she would like for her child to take care of her in the end because she had raised her to a certain point of adulthood, of course, and she felt as though, you know, that was the right thing to do. So I guess we can start off by, in my opinion, starting off with that guilt factor, because so many people think, are we really obligated as children or the next of kin to really take on this type of a role? And secondary, my second question would be, where do we begin?
Yeah, both of them really important questions. I can't answer the question, do you have to take on this role? Are you obligated? Because that's always going to be a personal decision. For me, I have family obligations. I have family loyalty. And so for me, it was something that I just felt like it was the right thing to do. I'm not a person who likes to watch someone else suffer, so I'm the kind of person who would step in and say, no, let me handle it. Let me take care of you. Let me see what I can do to help. That's just who I am. I know that for some people, it's depending on the relationship you've had with a parent, you know, not all relationships are good, and sometimes they've been very painful. And there may be a time when you say, you know what, I'm not obligated. I think that people are justified in not choosing to be the caregiver, you know, when there's been so much damage in the relationship. But, the guilt is a tough one. One of my perspectives on that is that if you've done something wrong, if you really have something to be guilty about, then you should feel appropriate guilt. It's a gift we have inside of us to say, wait a minute, think about this. See if you want to change your mind and get it right. But we don't have to feel irrational guilt. If we are doing the best we can. We cannot do more than we're humanly possible able to do. So you can't beat yourself up if you're just doing the best you can. You're trying to raise children. You maybe, you know, are trying to hold two jobs. I mean, everyone's struggling out there. So it's a tough thing to choose to take on. I find there are certain kinds of people that just naturally, you know, gravitate to that kind of role because they're just very giving. And others, they can't bear to witness their loved one getting worse.
Exactly.
So if we wanted to start with where should we begin, one of the things that a lot of caregivers do is they first don't even realize they're being a caregiver. They get kind of just started, okay, I'll just take my mom to the doctor this week. And my mom needs me to pick up some supplies. And it kind of sneaks up on you. So sometimes people don't choose it. It kind of chooses us. But no matter when it hits you, oh, my goodness, I'm a caregiver, the first thing you want to start doing is to build a team of support people around you and your loved one, because you cannot do it alone. There's no way that you can meet the needs of another person all by yourself. There are wonderful resources that are free out in the community for each disease, type of disease, whether it's a stroke or dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. There are organizations which can help, all free. There's also in every town something called an Area Agency on Aging, and they will help. There's all sorts of resources out there. So the first thing I tell people is build a team. Ask people from your faith community, could you drive mom on this Sunday because I can't always be picking her up. Could you help out? Even if your loved, your siblings, like your brothers and sisters, are far away, that doesn't mean they couldn't do some of the research. They could do some of the internet search for the right doctor or for the right wheelchair. Everyone can pitch in, and then it doesn't all just burden one person. The other thing that I really encourage people to do is to educate themselves, because as it goes on, you'll get more and more tired, and you won't have the time to reach out and continue to educate yourself about what the needs will be and what's coming next. So right at the beginning, if you can, take some time, learn about the disease, learn about the resources in your community, and start from there. I've been a caregiver for 4 members of my family, and it was a long, hard road. I can totally relate to your listeners.
Right. And one of the things, just to backtrack a little bit, is I know that a lot of the people that I know are only children, and their parents had them at an older age, and a lot of their family members are also older. So it's very important that they learn to find external resources, because a lot of times we can't just depend on other family members to come in, because again, we're living in a me first society, and right now, you know, with the economy the way it is, so many people are taking on 2 jobs, 2.5 jobs, or however you want to say it, and there's just no time. But you know, I guess my biggest concern with so many of my listeners in the past week, and I think I had expressed this to you earlier, was the fact that so many people are also afraid to even face this issue. They don't even want to talk about it. They don't want, they just don't want, it's almost like, I don't want to talk about the fact that a family member might get sick. I don't want, I'm not ready. And, you know, this show is about getting prepared so that you are ready.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm good.
Yeah, no, it just, you know, it's, I know it's scary. And, you know, I know that for some people, it's not something they're comfortable in their culture. I work in healthcare. I work in different hospitals. And some of the people I work with from different communities, they're not used to talking about it. And then we're not used to talking about it because, you know, people didn't used to talk about it. Seniors aren't comfortable because they're just, that's not how they did it. You know, and then there's personal worry. If I say it out loud, am I asking for that to come true? I mean, some people believe that you shouldn't speak something because it might make it happen. And so there are all these things that really get in the way of us talking about it. But I'm really worried when people don't at least have a little conversation about such issues, because I'm the one that goes and cleans up the mess in the hospital. When nobody's talked about it, nobody knows the right thing to do. The family's being torn apart because everyone's arguing. The patient's suffering because nobody can get their act together and figure out the right thing to do. And I'm in there trying to help everyone sort it out, and it doesn't need to be like that. If you can have some small conversations early on, and I'll tell you in just a few moments about how to do that, because it's not, doesn't have to be so hard. If you have some small conversations early on when you're in that crisis, you'll be like, you know what, this is terrible, I can't believe this has happened, but I know what to do. Grandma told me, my dad told me, whoever it is you're taking care of, I feel strong because I can speak for them and do right by them. So one of the things I really encourage families to do is not make this about being old. Everyone thinks that the conversation has to happen because you're old, so you must be getting close to dying. Well, accidents can happen to all of us. Everyone can have a moment when they're too sick to speak for themselves. I mean, you might have to have surgery, and you have pain afterwards, so they keep you sedated for a couple days. Who's going to talk to the doctor? Or maybe you're in a small accident, and you're going to be fine, but for a while, you can't talk for yourself. Who's going to be speaking for you? So it's important. I don't know if your listeners, I know in America we have something called advanced directives. I think internationally they have some form. I don't think it's the same name, but you can check your community. There's a form people can fill out that says two main things. Who should speak for me if I can't speak, and what they should say. And so when you fill out this form, and then you have somebody sign it, you have to do it the right way. It doesn't have to be done by a lawyer. It's just a free form you can get online. You can actually go to my website and download the instructions on how to do it and where to get it. That my website is thecaregiverspath.com. And go to my resource page, and it's right there. It's called An Insider's Guide to Advanced Directives. You can fill it out in a way that when the family is in that hospital room at your bedside and the doctor says, what should we do? You'll be able to hand that to him and say, we know what my mom would want. Let's respect her wishes. Let's give her a voice in the way her body is going to be treated. So what I did with actually one of my family members, my husband's family was very worried. They really wanted to fill this out, but they didn't know how. They were kind of concerned and nervous about it. So we did it as a big family group. Everybody got their own form in front of them, and we just all went through it together. So it wasn't about being old or being sickly. It was about making sure we all have our voice, and then the way it works is then you get respected. Then you have power when you're powerless. And we just all did it together, and I'll have to say, kind of got funny because the two eldest brothers started kind of teasing each other, like, you know, well, I want to be in charge of pulling your plug, and I want, you know, I mean, people, you know, it doesn't have to be terrible. I mean, everyone started giggling, and we all got to hear each other's voices about what was important to each other, and that's powerful because if that family's ever sitting in that hospital room by themselves, they'll know. They can turn to each other and say, you know what? Remember on that day, we heard what she wanted.
And that's a good point because, you know, when I was first initially thinking about this, I just left it at the fact that, you know, this person is going to be ill or they won't be able to speak for themselves. And the odd part is a few weeks ago I had taken my mom in for some surgery. And at the doctor's office, they had the package for the directive. And I picked up a copy. And I think that it's good for our listeners to remember that instead of you waiting for that dreaded moment, you know, when your time is either where you're too old to speak for yourself or you get into an accident or some type of an injury or illness where you are no longer able to, while you are of sound mind and body, you can direct, you know, what you want, how you want things done. And then that way, there won't be any bickering among family members or one family member wants to be the boss and let everyone else do, you know, tell everyone else what to do when that family member doesn't appear to have a clue themselves. So, I think for our listeners, we need to understand that we can do this ourselves and leave that paperwork there so that in the event that something happens, everyone can just sit around, read the paperwork, and do whatever the instructions call for on the paperwork. Again, we're here with Vicki Kine. She is the author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. We are talking about when you have to make those hard decisions or preparing for in case that time comes or when that time comes when a loved one is no longer able to care for and speak for themselves, and you may have to step up to the plate and be that person to step in. Again, if you have any questions or comments for Vicki, our number is 646-478-4726. Our lines are open. Right now, our switchboard appears to be stable, so feel free to call in for our guest in our chat room. If you have a question, feel free to type it, and I will read it for you on air for Vicki to give you her response.
Okay, so one thing you said is really important, and when you leave that paperwork for somebody, you have to leave it where they can find it. I remember when we had that famous Terry Schiavo case in Florida. The lawyers would get on the TV and say, make sure you put it in your safe deposit box. It's like, are you kidding? Nobody can ever get it. Only you can, and you're too sick. So the places you're supposed to put copies of this, of course you give it to the person and the alternates who might be making the choices for you. You give a copy to your doctor or to your doctors. You can even drop one off to your local hospital if you've been there before and they have a patient chart for you. You can leave one there. And then in your house, if the ambulance ever comes to your house, they're going to look one of three different places for your paperwork. They're going to look in your medicine cabinet, so you can tape it in there on the inside of the medicine cabinet, at your bedside, or on the refrigerator. Because they go looking to see where you keep your medicines, because that gives them information about what might be wrong with you. And so those are the three places they go, the kitchen, the bedside, and the bathroom, the main bathroom. So that's where you should keep your papers. Now, I travel a lot for work, so I actually keep some with me in my purse when I travel, because it is important to me that my wishes are respected. It's important that people honor my life, my choices. You know, if you have special needs of things that would be important to you, whether you want certain prayers done or you don't want that terrible family member visiting you, write it down, because that's the only way us in the healthcare field will know how to do right by you. You've got to tell us. And when you're talking about relatives, oh my goodness, sometimes it becomes whoever's the loudest, most obnoxious person in the family takes over. And most of us do not want that person in our family to be our decision maker. I mean, I've got one of those. It's like, please, stay out of my hospital room. So that's one of the best reasons to fill this out, is to write on the form not only who you want to be part of your decisions, but who you don't want.
You know, and again, that's something that, wow, I never gave much thought to that, and I had no idea that there were certain places that, you know, it's sort of the norm or standard procedure, I guess you could say, for them to look for this information. Now, for me, I wear a medical alert bracelet, and they have certain, you know, I'm in certain databases and things like that, but, of course, that just tells them the medications that I cannot take and what's wrong with me right now. You know, I don't have an updated one. If I find out that I have some type of a terminal illness next week, of course, that's not listed on my medical alert bracelet that I'm currently wearing. But, you know, that's good information. And, again, where did they normally look for? The refrigerator was one. I remember that.
Right. The medicine cabinet, like put it on the – you know how you open the medicine cabinet door in your bathroom? Tape it in there or at your bedside, like right near the lamp at your bedside or in the drawer right there. Those are the kinds of places they look.
And
now you can also, one other place, you should take a little piece of paper and write where you keep it, who should be called, like some phone numbers of family members, and stick it in your wallet. Because if you're ever in an accident away from the rest of your family, what happens in the emergency room or the emergency department is that what the person called the social worker, she's in charge of taking care of all the human part of the care you're getting, not just the medicine, and she'll go through your wallet and she'll find that little card saying, here's my decision maker's phone number, here's an alternate to call, here's where I keep my advance directive, here's the phone number of my doctor. Take a little piece of paper and stick it in your wallet, and then just forget about it. It's fine. You'll know you'll be protected.
Well, two questions that I came to mind. Now, one of these, I'm sure that this will clarify for the callers. Like, when I had my home built, one of the rules had changed for home building, so we didn't have medicine cabinets put into our house when it was built because it wasn't, you know, a standard requirement anymore. So you go into all of our bathrooms, there are no medicine cabinets. It was like they just got, just like in the basement, there's no, you know, the drainage basin, they don't even put those in because the laws when these homes were built had changed. So in the event that you do not have a medicine cabinet, would you suggest that they put it in? Because you still do have, like, the cabinets beneath the bowls and things like that. Or could you put it on the inside door of the cabinet there, since some homes do not have medicine cabinets and some people have not put in their own because there are no medicine cabinets in my entire house?
Oh, well, that's good. No one's ever asked me that question. That's a great question. The thing is, where do you keep your medicines? The medicines you take each day, where do you usually keep them?
Now, I keep them down the bottom. Well, they're either on the one of the shelves I put in, you know, shelves. But the majority of them, of course, they need to be in dark places. So I put them in the cabinets beneath the you know, the wash bowl. And that's where I keep them. So I was thinking maybe there could be a holder and maybe just stick it in there.
Yeah, so that's where I would put it. I might put, since you have some medicines out on the counter, you know, I might put a little tiny note there saying, my advanced directive is under the cupboard, you know, right below you.
Right. Right.
And then I would just, what you do is you just either put it like in a big manila envelope, and then on the outside in big letters write advanced directive, or if you're in a state called a living will, they're slightly different names, but put it, tape it to the inside of the door so when they go, because that's what they're looking for, because the emergency medical technician, the ambulance driver, he doesn't know what's wrong with you. He doesn't know your health conditions. And so they go looking, and they look hard for your medicine. So keep it where your medicine is.
Okay. And the second thing is, I know for me, I have certain legal documents that I have to carry with me at all times, you know, like a final protection order and things like that. So could you also, and I keep those in a protective plastic, like a page protector, but I keep all that paperwork together in there. And, of course, wherever I go, I have to keep those papers on me. I have a copy in my car. I have a copy in my purse. Would you suggest the same things? Could we do that also? Because if you're traveling a lot, I could be in Maryland like I am right now, and then I could be heading to Georgia after I'm done with the show. So,
I would keep it either in my purse if I'm a woman or in my briefcase if I'm a man, wherever you keep your other important documents. And say you don't want to carry the whole thing with you, you can put a little note in your wallet again saying, I always keep one at the hotel. Here's the hotel's name. You know what I mean?
Okay.
You can make it work for you. So if you're, like for women, it's pretty easy. It's only a few pages long. It's not a huge document. You can fold it up into like four pieces and tuck it in. Into your purse, because most of us carry a big purse. You can, if you're a man, you can maybe put it into your briefcase or, you know, as long as somebody can be reached. So that's why if you can, like a lot of times, I don't know if you do this in your state, but we use on our phones, we use the word ICE, I-C-E, which is in case of emergency. So we put a couple people's names, instead of under their names, we put them under the word ICE. And then when people call, when the, you know, say you're in a problem, they look at your phone and they see who your ICE person is, and then that person would have a copy and they could fax it to the hospital. So, you know, as long as you've got enough people knowing where it is, it will get to the doctors.
And I guess when you mentioned the ICE, I've never heard of it here, but it's something interesting to look into to see if that's some type of a standard here, because I've never heard of it. But for me, of course, my phones stay locked all the time, which means you need a password to even get in to look into it. You know, I would probably have one phone, because I have several, you know, some are personal and one is for business and things like that. Maybe I would do it for one and leave that one unlocked or I don't know if you can do a special override code for emergency, but
yeah, I don't know if that's because they don't need to know it. So I mean, you could always just put a little note in your phone case, you know, saying who to call. I mean, you just do the best you can. I mean, you cannot, you know, I don't want people to think, oh my gosh, I've got to have them plastered all over the house. And I mean, you just do the best you can. And the most important part of this whole process, it's important to have the forms, because that's a nice legal document that if there is a problem with the doctor not listening to your wishes or your family becoming a problem, I can go in there and take charge and say, no, she wrote it down. We're going to listen to what she would like. But the other part of this is that you've got to have the conversation. You wouldn't believe how many times people come to the hospital and we find their paperwork and we call the person that's listed as their decision maker. Some places call it a surrogate decision maker or an agent or a proxy. There's different names. But we find that name and number. We call the person and we're like, so what did she tell you she would want? And they're like, I didn't even know she picked me. We never talked about it. Well, now it doesn't do you any good because you didn't empower your decision maker. You empowered her on paper, but you didn't give her voice. So that's why you really have to sit down and have these conversations. And here's where most people make a mistake when they're planning what to write down and what to tell their decision makers. Most forms only ask you what kind of tests you would like or what kind of procedures would you like if you're in a coma or if you're in this kind of situation. So they're asking you medical questions. But for most of us, we don't understand medicine. We don't know when we would want certain procedures or surgeries. Here's what you really should write down on your form. And there's a box, usually a section called Other, where you can write it, or you can actually staple another page to your advance directive. What people need to write down is what would be a meaningful recovery. What kind of life would I want to have if my brain had been so damaged that I'm not going to speak for myself? How would I want to live? What kind of life would I want? So here's what my paragraph says. I say that I value a full and meaningful life, not just a long life. If I can't interact with people and not recognize my loved ones, you know, and have some meaning, I wouldn't want to live like that. I don't want to be a burden on others. So those are the kinds of things that I wrote about in mind. Now, that's just my personal opinion. Nobody else has to agree with me on that. That's just my paragraph. So someone else's paragraph might say, do not give up on me. Make sure the priest or the rabbi or whoever comes and gives me all the right prayers. Don't give up. Fight as hard as you can, because even if I'm in a terrible condition, I still want to live, you know?
Right.
It was funny. I was talking about this with my niece, my adult niece, and she had to go through some surgeries, and she was going to fill out her form, and I was talking it through with her, and she said, Vicki, even if I didn't recognize people, that might be fun because every day would be new and I get to meet people again. And I thought, wow, that's a whole different way to look at it. You know, I'm looking at it would be such a burden, you know, to not be able to recognize people. And she didn't think that would be so bad. So that's what she wrote down, that she wouldn't mind living like that. So that's what the doctors don't know about you. They know what medical tests to do, what medical treatments to give you, but they don't know your life goal. They don't know what's meaningful to you, what brings you joy, and how many different things could you lose before you'd say, I don't want to live like this. So those are the kinds of things that make this document really powerful, and it makes the conversations you're having with your loved ones powerful, because it's not about medicine at this point. I write a lot about this in my book. The doctors get all focused on medicine and lab tests and x-rays. It's not about that. It's what kind of life you're going to have when you leave the hospital. Where are you going to live? What's it going to feel like to be inside your body? What's your pain going to be like? What other kinds of suffering will you have? that's what we need to start talking about.
Right. And I feel as though so many people, like you said, the person had said they didn't even know. So many people are uncomfortable, I won't say afraid, but uncomfortable to talk about their wishes because they don't want to hurt someone else's feelings. I know many, many years ago when we were talking after a family member had passed, and I said, you know, someone had asked me what I'd want to do with my child in the event that something happened to me. And I gave them my wishes, and then another family member was highly upset because, you know, what do you mean you would want this person to be the guardian of the child and not me? And I said, you know, I have my reasons, and, you know, well, you look like a fool, and everybody thought you were a fool for saying that because you should have said me. And I'm like, you know, but this isn't your wish, it's my wish.
Yeah.
So,
oh my gosh. You can't win, can you? You know, you finally are brave enough. You took a stand, which most parents won't, you know, and then that, you know, unfortunately I've had a couple different people in my life whose parents died, and you know, people had to fight over the kids because nobody would say it before. So here you are doing the right thing, speaking up, and then people give you a hard time about it. You know, but ultimately it was your child. It was your life, your values, your beliefs, and that's where a lot of bioethics comes in. We actually use something in bioethics called substituted judgment, and it's this tool we use to help people be the person speaking for the other person, but they're supposed to remember that it's not about them. So the way substituted judgment works is you think about what your loved one would want. Say it's your father. What would my dad say if he could understand what's happened to his body, what's going on with his life and the condition he's in, how he's going to be in the future? What would my dad say? And then that's what you're supposed to say out loud to the doctor or to the family. It's not about our body. It's not about our life and our values and beliefs. It's about the person we're taking care of. Now, for most people, that gives them a lot of relief and a lot of peace of mind because it's hard enough to be asked, what do you want to do? What should we do for your father? But when you realize, wait a minute, I'm not really making the decision. I'm just speaking for my dad. This is my dad. I'm honoring and respecting. I really think it's an act of love to have the courage to speak for that other person in a way that honors their life. Now, sometimes it's terrible because we have to say aloud something that we don't like. You know, just like you had to say aloud, this is who I would want to take care of my child, and you would have to have other people be upset about it, but you still have to do it. We have an ethical obligation to that other person. They can't speak for themselves anymore. Your child could not protect herself or himself from a difficult family member. You had to step in and protect that child, just like we'd have to step in and protect our elders at a certain point.
Right. I have another interesting scenario for you that had come in earlier in the week. A blended family, say a couple gets married, they already have children outside of the marriage, and then they also have children between the two of them. So if one of the spouses, you know, meets with an untimely death, again, in that directive, can they or should they write, you know what, I don't want the siblings to be split up, because then the biological absentee parent or their family may want to come in and say, oh, he or she died, I want this child. And the question then becomes, you know, even though my spouse died, this was their wish, this was their directive, that they wanted us to fight to keep the siblings together for the best interest of the child. So they would know that even though this particular biological parent is gone, you know, it was their wish for us to fight in court or wherever so that the absentee parent and or their family will not be able to come in and take that child out of the environment that he or she has known their entire life, and then, of course, take them away from their siblings. Who are they? You know, this is the only family that they've ever known. So is that something that,
it sounds it sounds like you're right on track with that. I mean, we always start, I mean, one of the things about being an American is that we have individual rights. We have our individual voice. You know, you're allowed to say, this is what's important to me, this I don't like. Like in some other countries and cultures, it's more important to fit into the group. It's more important to make sure your family is happy with you than your own personal beliefs. But
right.
Here in America, we always start from that person's wishes. So, again, if that person said, I do not want my child split up, this is the family, he's used to being raised by my new wife, this is the right thing, these are my wishes, then they should be followed, absolutely, because nobody knows how to raise your child better than you do. You know what I mean? And I just,
exactly.
I can't imagine, this happens all the time, I know, but, you know, we have to respect who's in charge, you know, and thank goodness this person wrote it down, because can you imagine the fight that might go to court? Because the child is not the biological child of the new spouse, and, oh, my gosh, they're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars fighting over this child, and it's not in the child's best interest. You know, that's another phrase we use a lot is, what is in the best interest of the person, whether it's a child or a grown-up, that we're making decisions for? We're supposed to be watching out for them. It's actually one of those obligations that we talk about in ethics, that we have what's called a fiduciary responsibility, and we never use that word. It's a strange word, fiduciary. But what it means is that when you're in that role of being in charge of someone else, whether it's in charge of their money, like a guardian or conservator, or in charge of their health or their life, you're supposed to do what's right for them, even if it's not right for you. Your primary obligation is to think about them. And that's also part of our law. So when people start to come in and try to do something different than what's in the best interest of that person, honoring their wishes, they're not on track ethically or legally. And it's just destructive. I'm sorry. You know, nobody wins in that situation.
Right. And another question, of course, thinking about this blended family scenario, would it be, now I know that some of these we can do ourselves and have them notarized and witnessed and things ourselves, but when it comes down to, of course, we're talking about minor children here who cannot speak for themselves, would you suggest that they have it drafted by a legal representative so that the family, it will be a lot harder for that non-custodial parent to challenge, let's say, the actual document, if it's actually drafted in an attorney's office or by an attorney, where there are, you know, minor children involved, there's a vulnerable adult, even a vulnerable adult that's involved.
Right. I think I'm not a lawyer, so I think in most circumstances when it's a very important decision like this, a vulnerable adult or a minor child or somebody with a disability, it may be important to go and at least talk to the lawyer about it and say, if I just write this down and have a notary sign it, is that just as good as if you sign it? Because sometimes the answer is yes, they both are legal documents. But you and I know that something that's written by a lawyer is probably going to stand up a little bit better in court. So in most of these situations, you know, I think people should use lawyers appropriately. I have no problem with using lawyers. The only form that I'm really not that thrilled with lawyers writing is that advance directive form. And the reason is, it's not because I don't trust them to do a nice job, but they make it too fancy, too long. They use legal words instead of medical words, and those fancy forms that the lawyers make confuse the doctors.
Right.
The doctors don't have time to read 12 pages of legal rambling, and so it just doesn't always work actually in that emergency room. So that's the only reason that I'm saying, no, for that one, don't do that. But all these other documents, absolutely. I know that I've actually used, you know, and I don't work for this company or anything, but I've used in America here, I've used a company called LegalZoom.com. And that's been very good because I haven't had to pay as expensive fees for my legal documents. You know, I set up my appropriate trust and I have my will. And, you know, I use the legal support, but I try to do it at a discount because, you know, all these things cost money.
Right.
You know, but every state's different too, so that's why you definitely want to go to someone in your state.
Right. And I can attest to LegalZoom too. I've used them on several occasions, but me being a student of law, you know, I want the listeners to understand that yes, there are some times when you have to really do your homework and be prepared and know what you're in for to make sure that you're not missing anything, and you know, read it aloud so that sometimes when you read things aloud, you tend to catch things or notice things that you may miss if you're just sitting there silently reading. So a lot of times it's good to reread it and reread it, but read it to yourself so that you can understand. And then, you know, again, this is about what you want, and you have to separate the trying to make the people that are left in the land of the living and the fully capable, you know, happy and doing what you know that in your heart, mind, and soul. You know, at some point your mind may be gone and you may have nothing left but your soul. So you have to make sure that it's what's right for you and not anyone else. And some people may get their feelings hurt or feel slighted for a moment, but if they really do appreciate your decision and they love you for who you are, then they'll get over it.
Sometimes, you know, we pick certain people to be our official decision maker. It doesn't mean that person can't go and sit down with the rest of the family and say, what do you think I should do? What did she ever say to you about this? Did you guys ever talk? I mean, because not everybody always knows. You may have to find information from lots of family members to build the right decision because it's not always perfectly clear. But sometimes it's best not to pick, like, your spouse or your partner or significant other, because sometimes it's too hard for them to make these choices, you know, because it's like, I can't bear to let you go, or I can't bear to see what's happened, you know. So sometimes, you know, I encourage people to think about really carefully choosing who that person's going to be. Can they handle themselves in an emergency, or are they the hysterical type who's just going to sit there and sob and scream? Now, I'm a weeper. I cry easily, but in the emergency, I do really well. And then, like, after it's all over, you know, I'll just sit there and sob. But I can handle the emergency. So I'm actually the decision maker for a number of my friends because they know that if it comes time for me to take action, I'm brave enough, I'm respectful enough, and I'm smart enough to ask a lot of good questions so I can make a good choice for them. You have to ask lots of questions and get the support you need. It's not that it's all just on your shoulders. You should be talking to the doctor, the social worker, your religious advisor, your cultural advisor. Reach out to all the other people that your loved one would actually be talking to. You know, if your loved one would turn to their best friend and say, I don't know, what do you think? Then call the best friend. You know, it's not that you have to be all alone on this journey. It's just, someone's got to be in charge because the doctor can't talk to 20 of you at a time.
Right. One voice.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
And
right.
It can be two voices if it's really important to you, but make sure those two people will work together. This one lady told me she picked her two sons, and they have never agreed on anything in their life. And I'm like, this is a disaster. They're going to fight. They're going to make the doctor's nightmare, you know? So make sure you have good people who can handle themselves, who can figure stuff out, who can work well with the rest of the team. You know, don't pick somebody who's an addict. Don't pick someone that lives so far away that they can't come and see you and see what's happened to you. You know, it's important to visit and to see the changes. because it's one thing to hear your loved one sick. I don't know if you've had that experience, but then to walk into the room and see it with your own eyes, hard.
Yeah.
But you need to see it with your eyes, because how can you make choices without really understanding?
Right. And it's so important because, you know, a few years ago I did have that. I had forgotten something, and I had to run back home, and the phone was ringing. And my mom was calling, and she was really ill. And I had to rush her to the hospital, and they took her right into surgery. And my brother lives in another state, you know, not a far state, but still out of this state. And, you know, when you go into the hospital, and the last time she was there, I guess he had taken her, and he was the only one on record. So the nurse, she looked up at me, and she asked me, was I sure that I was my mother's daughter? And I'm like, you know what? You know, it's these little things that we can, like, I'm pretty sure, but I'm going to go and get her now because, you know, you're telling me that the only person on record is my brother, and he's not here. He lives in another state. So I was like, Ma, you need to get up. I know that you're in pain, but I don't exist for this nurse, and she's not going to talk to me, so you need to come talk to these people. And I'm, you know, I'm just so lost in the process. And it's like, okay. You know, but these are the little things that people, if you want people to do right by you, you really do need to make sure that everyone's name is where it's supposed to be. And, you know, just talking to you, just bringing back all this stuff for me and giving me all these ideas that even I didn't even think about or know. So, again.
And we have these huge privacy laws here in America. And so you have all your medical records are private. I mean, hospitals can't even tell, like your loved one calls in and says, is my mom at the hospital? They can't tell you unless mom has given them permission. So on that form, you can actually write a list of here are all the people that the doctor can say how I'm doing, how they can give my medical information out to, you know, because we're so protective now that there's no space for community and family. So, you know, this is not about talking only about death. It's just about navigating the healthcare system. You know, I know these forms feel like the dying form, but it's just what can we do to make sure you're taken care of just when you're sick. It does work at death, but it also works during life. And the system's broken. We have to figure out how to be a better participant and to give the right people voice and be able to move information. And this is one way you can do it.
Yeah. And again, like I said, my story left me a little bit. I didn't know what to do. And I'm standing up here looking at the nurse, and she's looking at me with her hands folded like, I don't care who you claim you are, you're nowhere.
Yeah,
I was a little bit thrown, and like, okay, so my mom is sitting here. She really is sick, but you're not going to talk to me, and you're not even going to let me give you her information because I'm not in the record. So you know, and she needed major surgery. She was really sick,
Well,
you know, my brother didn't show up until hours later.
That's the stupidity of healthcare right now. You know, so as much as we all want to change it and complain about it. You know, yes, I like to complain about it too, but you got to deal with it. You've got to take action and take charge of your experience. So, you know, the fact that you marched down to the room, you got your mom, you got her to communicate, you know, what I would have done if I was in the room with you or if I was helping the healthcare team, I would have said, while your mom is feeling still good enough, I know she needs surgery, but she's still awake and alert, have her fill out the form. Give us permission to talk to her daughter. Put it in writing.
Yep.
And then she would be able to go to her surgery feeling at peace. Okay, my daughter has the power to take care of me. I feel better. I can go in and just worry about getting better.
Right.
So that's what she had to do.
You know, she said, this is my daughter. You can talk to her. Oh, well, so-and-so will give me this. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, and I'm still standing here like, seriously, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I was so thrown.
I love the sentence. Are you sure you're her daughter?
I remember she had this little blonde curly hair. She was heavy set. She bent over the counter and she's like, are you sure that you're her daughter? Because there's no record of you. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, no, I was just the taxi that bought her here. Of course I'm sure. I'm like, are you kidding me? And Mom, I'm like, Mom. And she's like, yes, this is my daughter. And she's like, oh, gosh, I need to sit down and die. You know, she was really sick. And and after that, the nurse was like, oh, okay. And then she looked at me like, I wonder if she coerced her. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm still standing here. Coercion?
Yeah.
You know, the healthcare system, I said, you guys are set up to kill people all post. What is the problem?
Yeah, well, sometimes the laws that are stuck all amongst, you know, all inside of healthcare are making it much harder. You know, it used to be you knew your doctor, he knew your family for your whole life, you know, and now it's just a bunch of strangers taking care of strangers.
It is, and that's the hurtful part is, you know, I'm not even comfortable with you. I don't know who you are. I don't know anything about you. You know, I like long-term relationships. You know, I keep the same legal team. I've had them for the last almost 18 years. You know, I like to have the same doctors. You know, my OBGYN, she finally retired and went back to her home country. And, she was my doctor from before, you know, I had my child. Right up through, and he's grown now with children of his own, but she was my doctor all those years, and that's what I'm comfortable with. But now it's what your book is all about. There's no compassion. There's no warmth. It's just cold, and it's not friendly, and it's not welcoming, and, you know, it makes me want to say, you know what, just let me stay home in my house, check on me every day if you know I'm sick. If I don't pick up the phone, it means 10 to 1, I'm probably already gone. I just don't want to be bothered with the medical system because, you know, my last few moments, I don't want to be stressed. I'm already stressed because I'm dying, you know, in my opinion, prematurely. And then I have to deal with these cold-hearted, stupid people. I was in the hospital once, and I told the nurse, I said, you know, I have a titanium plate in my spine. She says, I'm not familiar with titanium. Is that a plastic or a metal? I told her, you know what? How about you get out of my room? You know, nobody who's sick wants to hear that. It's like, where'd you go to school?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you expect a certain level of education and,
And the people that are left need to be vigilant to know, you know, you have to watch these healthcare providers and make sure that they're doing right by your loved one.
Yeah.
You know,
and you
just
really
so many things.
You really do. And you know what? And I am a huge fan of doctors and nurses and social workers and all the people that take care of us because, you know, there are some bad ones. I don't like them. But so many of them are really still trying. So I don't want to just sound like,
please don't.
Because they're just, trying
so
hard.
This is my personal experiences that were bad people. And I said, I also said that I had the same OBGYN for many, many years. My son is 26 years old. So, you know, I had that same doctor all those years. That's what I like, and that's what I'm looking forward to. But my last few experiences, these are my personal experiences. At no time am I saying all healthcare providers are bad, because they're not. But since we're talking about taking care of, you know, someone who can't speak for themselves, we have to be more vigilant and see what's going on, because that person who's lying in that hospital room at night when we go home, they cannot tell us the next morning, you know, well, this person came in, they were not, you know, I wasn't comfortable with them. They can't tell us that. We need to see what isn't right. We have to be more observant and vigilant of what's going on, and we need to be prepared to ask questions. That's, you know, but
you're completely right. You know, because they can't speak for themselves, they can't tell us I'm in pain. And so if the nurse doesn't stop by to check on them and doesn't take the time to notice, they're not going to get the right support. You know, so one of the things I remind families to do is, if you can, have somebody stay into the evening. You're allowed to sleep in the patient's room. You're not supposed to ever be a problem. You're not supposed to make it harder on the nurses, be in the way of the other patient in the room. So you have to be very polite and gracious, but you can be there as much as you want. That even though they say they have visiting hours, you're allowed to be there as long as you're not being disruptive. And you should check, like when they bring medicine in, ask them, what's the name of that medicine? What is it for? Because sometimes they're in a rush, you know, and errors happen all the time. I mean, we don't want to think that the hospital might make mistakes, but they're human. Mistakes happen for all of us, you know, and so you have to keep asking more questions. Why are you doing this? What, not to be difficult, you know, because if you start becoming the difficult family member, you're in trouble. So be very cooperative, be very grateful and appreciative. Like the thing I do every time a loved one or even a friend is in the hospital, I bring cookies or some kind of treat to the daytime nurses and the nighttime nurses. Mm-hmm. And I put a big note on the box saying, thank you from Mrs. Smith in room 22. Right. They're not from me. They're for me to make sure that they know Mrs. Smith appreciates how much they're taking care of her. And bringing those cookies, they don't have to be homemade or anything, that will get your loved one more attention and more support, because the nurses work like crazy. They work so hard. They have so many patients to take care of that when you say thank you, that just makes that 12 hours better for them. So you're actually making it better for all the patients that day. So you can make that setting better. You know, ask questions, be respectful, but if it's not going okay, you can always fire the doctor. Even in a hospital, you can fire the doctor and get a new one, and I highly recommend that if it's not going right. And the other person you can turn to is somebody called the Ethics Committee or the Bioethics Committee. In every hospital, it's a federal law that they have to have something called this Ethics or Bioethics Committee. And so when a doctor's not listening to your mom's wishes, or you're not getting the right care, and you're just like, this is not right, this shouldn't be happening, your gut is just all torn up, you pick up the hospital phone and you ask for the operator and you ask to speak with someone from one of these committees. And then within a few hours, usually someone will call you back, and then they'll come in. There's a team of people who come in and they don't have an agenda. Their agenda is to sort it all out and to make sure the patient's getting the right care, and they'll come in and help you. They'll help you talk to the doctors. They'll help your family sort things out. It's all free. Every hospital has these people, and you need to know, listeners need to know that you do have a voice. You do have someone who will advocate for your family while you're there. So that's one of my favorite things about talking about my book and the work I do, because nobody knows that we exist, that we're in hospitals just waiting to help people. So call when you're in trouble.
Right. And another thing that I like to do, I know when I'm in the hospital, is the people who come to change your linen and things, because Lord knows it's nothing like fresh linen when you're in the hospital, especially if you've had a fever all night and you're just broke, you know, thank them as well, because they will give you that special effort, and especially if you're mobilized, you know how they have to roll you up and put on one side of the sheet and then roll you to the other side. If they don't have the machine to lift your body out to keep it stable, then that takes a lot of work, and it doesn't hurt to say thank you or smile at those people who usually go unnoticed in the hospital, because there are so many who, the unsung heroes, who never get that thank you or who never get that recognition, because, you know, they just do their job and people are like, you're supposed to do it, you're gone. And if you're not, don't have an MD or RN or something behind your name or in front of your name, you know, sometimes they just go ignored and they just blend into the whole hospital atmosphere. So for me, I like to carry on conversations with them and see how their day is going, you know.
Because you're a good person, you're a sweetheart.
You know, just to make them feel, I'll tell it, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, people, if you have a home care nurse and she comes in and goes the extra mile and she cleans up your bathroom or straightens up for you or something, it doesn't hurt. You'd be surprised how smiling at someone and saying thank you means so much because they never hear it. And it's the little things that mean so much to some people. And, you know, for all of our me-first society and the way that we have become so self-centered, sometimes it's the little things that still mean so much in this world. And, again, we're speaking with Vicki Kine. She is the author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. And our discussion has been so enlightening this evening because you have given me so much things to think about. Even though I had the paperwork, of course, when I took my mom a few weeks ago and I picked up the directive, I haven't done a thing with it, you know. And my mom called me earlier today because it's like 110 is what it is here today, or it feels like 110. And I have severe asthma. So she wanted to make sure that I wasn't outside. And, you know, if I go outside and walk three steps, you know, I can't breathe after that. So, you know, for me, anything can happen at any time, and I know that. And, you know,
so are you brave enough now to fill it out?
You know, it's not the fact that I'm not brave enough to do it, because, you know, I'm that person that's the rebel with a cause. So I'll fill it out. You know, my thing is I'm so busy, and I have to make the time to do it. That's the difference for me, is that I haven't sat down to do it. You know, I just haven't made the time to do it. And I think that that's something where I have to really look in the mirror and say, you know what? Say you have a massive asthma attack right now tonight. What's everybody going to do? You know, no one would know what I want. And I have it all in my head. I know how I want everything to play out. You know, I know what I want people to do and how I want it to be done. And of course, it's in my head, but nobody knows. You know, I may tell, a lot of times I may call my daughter-in-law and say, you know what, you can have this and do this and that, but she doesn't really know where anything is or who to call, because I've never sat down and really given her everything that she would need to pass it along to my son and my mom and my family. You know, because for me, my mom is older, and I don't want her to take on the burden all alone. And, you know, I just want people to know, you know, who I can depend on to do what when it needs to be done. And, you know, I want them to know, don't worry about me. Whatever's about to happen to me, it's my time for it to happen, and I'm going to be okay. You know, even if, you know, my days of being here physically are over, I'm moving on to whatever the next plane is in the cycle of life. So I'm good, you know, but
good.
I want
well,
them
you know
to
what?
Know
if,
what's left.
If you can write some of these words down, just sit, and it doesn't, you know, everyone thinks it has to be perfect or it has
right.
to even be forever. Put something down. And then if you want to change it in 6 months or 5 years from now or something else comes to you, add it. It's okay.
Right.
But get something down, because it sounds like you have strong wishes about how you would be taken care of, how you would want people to react to your situation if you were dying, how things should be taken care of after you're gone. And if anyone has strong opinions about these, please write them down, because then we can respect them. Then we can truly feel like I've done right by my loved one. You know, I knew what to do for my aunt. I knew exactly how to handle things. She had given me a list of who to call after she was gone. She gave me a list of where all her bank accounts and all her important papers were. She didn't have to keep writing that paper. She just had to do it once. So all of these things probably would only take you, if you really did everything you needed to, maybe a couple hours. And this advanced directive form, you could probably do in 30 minutes easily. And it will give you peace of mind, because when your family is faced with an end-of-life decision or some other critical decision, they'll be able to say, oh, thank you, thank you for giving me this because I now know what to do. You know, it's hard enough to be in that position in the crisis and your brain wants to explode and you can't believe it's happening and then not to know. You know, it's this huge gift we give our loved ones. And you don't have to keep thinking about it. You know, do it today, do it this week, give yourself a deadline, and then be done with it. And then it just sits and it's there for you.
Right.
Something that you mentioned earlier, and I just wanted to backtrack to that, is that you said that you wouldn't want, you know, you would just want to be left alone, have a peaceful death. I think that's something that you were saying. You kind of said it differently.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't want.
Yeah, if I fall out tonight, you know, pay me a call. If you don't hear from me, you know, I'm probably here gone. But, you know, yeah. I don't want a lot of fans saying, oh, gosh, I'm so sorry. Look, you know, it's part of life. I have some health conditions, you know. I know that, you know, I take every moment like it could be my last because it could. You know, there are some people who take breathing for granted. When you have severe asthma, that's taken away. And, you know, I could be riding down the street and sometimes I'm behind a truck that has a mulch or something on it or fertilizer, and it sends me into an attack while I'm riding down the highway. You know, and
it's a terrible feeling.
You know, it is.
I've had that kind of asthma. Luckily, mine's very managed right now, but
mm-hmm.
I took it for granted, too. I mean, I remember walking just like three cars from one car to three cars away, and I actually had to stop and stand there. My brother's like, are you all right? I'm like, I just have to catch my breath. I mean, you don't know what that feels like until you go through it. And,
exactly.
And so, you know, you understand how life is precious, and you live it the best you can each day. You do right in the world, and then if your time comes, you have peace.
Yep, and that's it, you know. And I'm going to live it my way. I can't live it for anyone else because they'll still be here and they'll be able to live their life. And I'm like, while I can, I'm going to live it my way. You know, and this is why, again, I do this show and I have people like yourself on to let our listeners know, hey, you know what? Again, my motto, of course, for this show is real people, real stories, real hurt, real healing. You know, I'm a real person. You're a real person. And we're telling you real stories and we're giving you real options for healing and trying to live as much as you can, but be prepared. Now, for this show, of course, it's being prepared for in case the end is near. So, you know, for me, this has been great because it's really opened up my eyes and I believe that I touched on a lot of things that I've been speaking with, you know, my listeners about for the last few weeks. And, of course, you've helped me to open up my eyes to a lot of things that I didn't think about that I really do need to do here for myself as well. And that's the great part about this conversation. And before we have about 15 minutes left, tell us where we can pick up a copy of your book, because I do believe that listeners need to get this book because it is chock full of information, and it's not something where it's a lot of medical jargon where you won't know what Vicki's trying to tell you. It's written so that you can follow it and understand what you need to do, and it's not an intimidating book, but it does give you a lot of information that you will feel comfortable reading and understanding. And it's really step by step.
Yeah, you know, that's my gift. For some reason, I can make tough stuff easy. I can explain things in a way that people can go, oh, that's easy. I can understand that. So I don't write fancy. I don't write it complicated. I try to make it as easy to learn as possible. I also try to make you feel really strong along the way. This is not a book about making you feel weak because you have to face things. It's actually about making you feel strong. I can face it. I'm educated now. I can do the right thing. So I really wanted it to feel like a comfort also, because we all feel so alone in these moments, and you don't have to be alone. Somebody said to me that my book feels like a trusted friend. someone they can turn to at different times. Because I write about the long journey, not just, you know, when someone's sick, but I also write about it, you know, if death is approaching. So people can get my new book at any of the major online sites like Amazon.com, Barnes & Nobles, Borders, Books A Million. It's also in local bookstores. So you can go to an independent bookstore or another bookstore in your community and support our local bookstores because, you know, everyone's buying online now. If people want an autographed copy, they can buy it off of PayPal through my website at thecaregiverspath.com. And so I'm just so fortunate that I now have this opportunity to help make people feel safer about facing these decisions.
Right.
I wanted to share one story that really has helped me about beginning to think about the dying process. One of the reasons I became a hospice volunteer is because I had four adult senior family members to take care of, and I knew I was going to be facing all this death and dying stuff, and I was afraid. I was just like most people. I'm like, I don't know anything about it. I don't know what death looks like or feels like. I'm afraid. And so I went and became a hospice volunteer, and they give you all this education. And one of the stories that they told me and that I've actually used in my work with others that's really helped me is that the labor of death is very much like the labor of birth. And so when people are born and you've had a child, like when you were delivering your son, you have a son, right? When you were delivering your son, you didn't have to tell your uterus, okay, now it's time to contract. You know, now it's time. The body knew what to do. The body said, it's time. I'm going to go into action. I know what to do to get this baby out. And it's this natural, normal process, a little painful, of course, a lot painful, but the body knew how to deliver that child. And ultimately, your son knew how to be born. It's the same journey in the labor of death. Our bodies know how to die. When people are dying in the early months before they're going to die, they get a little quieter. They're sleeping more. Maybe they're not as hungry as they used to be. Maybe when the family comes over, they're not as attached to everyone. They're kind of pulling away. They're starting to focus on their own internal journey and what they need to do to make peace with the death that's approaching. And then as it gets closer, they're eating even less. Maybe they're not hungry at all. Maybe they're sleeping all the time. Maybe they don't have the strength to do what they used to do. And then even in the hours of dying, the body does certain things and behaves in certain ways because that's how the body turns off. So all of things that seem so frightening are actually normal and natural and just tell you that the body is doing this beautifully. Just like there's beauty in the birth of a child, even though it's kind of a strange experience, the same thing is true when people die. It's so normal and natural. I was working with a woman and her son, who was about, I don't know, 30-something, he had some terrible cancer, and he was going to be at home with hospice. And hospice is a free service. They come to your house. They bring you what you need. They respect what you need and what you don't need. They listen to you. And so we were there helping her, and I was there on that last day of his life. And, you know, he was having a fever, and then he would get very cold, and then he would breathe very fast, and then he would breathe very slow. And all of these things kind of frightened her because she'd never seen death. And I said to her, it's really normal. We see this all the time. This is how the body knows to start turning off. And every time I was able to share with her that he's doing it right, this is normal and natural, she could relax. She could just remember that she's the mom and she could just hold him and love him and she wasn't so afraid. And so I know that this topic is very scary. I know that people don't know what to expect because you probably haven't seen it. But I will tell you the journey of dying is incredibly beautiful. We sometimes do need the support of the people from hospice to help with any pain or any other symptoms, so it's good to have them there to support you. But it's as lovely as being born, and your body will know what to do. You don't have to be afraid.
And, you know, if I may add to that, you know, when you were speaking about my son and his birth, of course, with my son, you know, I did the Lamaze training and all of that, and I was prepared, and, you know, I'm bringing this new life into the world. And then, of course, something went very wrong. He was a C-section baby because, you know, we found out after 20-plus hours of hard labor that, you know, the baby was just too big, and there was no way that I could deliver. So, again, when that unexpected or that problem arises, and I remember to this day the bells going off, and I remember hearing someone yelling, "We're losing them both," and everything got kind of like in slow motion, and I was like, "I'm fine. Oh, all the pain stopped," and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I saw people running around, but they were in slow motion, and I was like, "I feel great." You know, but at the time, like now I know that we were dying, I guess you could say, but those people around me knew what had to be done.
Yes.
And it's the same process when you're at the end of life as it is at the beginning of life. When you're faced with that obstacle or that problem that's come up, you have to be prepared to know how to handle it. And,
yes,
you know, that's the other end of it is, you know, great, birth is wonderful. You know, most people think, yeah, pop the baby out, da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, well, yeah, I was expecting that. And then something went really, really wrong. And I remember when I first got to the hospital, I said, they didn't tell me this at Lamaze.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, this wasn't supposed to happen this way. I mean, nothing happened the way that it was supposed to. You know, nothing. They had to break my water, you know, nothing. The plug, you know, none of that happened like it's supposed to, none of it. And I was like, okay, I'm at a total loss now because they didn't teach me this. So it's the same process. You really should be prepared. They teach you everything but what happens in case it doesn't happen this way. That's something that, you know, we're not taught. We have to, you know, find that out for ourselves and be prepared. So.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons I'm a huge fan of hospice is because even though they don't stay with you all the time, they're just a phone call away. Any minute of the day, you can pick up the phone and talk to an RN nurse who's highly trained in managing all the things that can go wrong and hopefully go right. And so and then they can immediately send someone to your house. You have all the medicines to take care of your loved one, whether they're struggling to breathe with air hunger, or if they're having some pain, some other symptoms, they already have all the supplies in your house, so the nurse can say, okay, you know that pill we haven't used yet, but I've already got it there for you. Go over there, take one out, put it under his tongue or whatever it is that he needs, and then immediately you get taken care of. If you tried to take your loved one to an emergency room, you'd sit there for hours, you know, but hospice is right on there with you. They're right on that team with you. They are the most expert at managing these things. Unfortunately, the hospitals are not very good at death just because, you know, they're so busy trying to save lives, they don't really know how to ease that journey. And so, you know, I always tell people, please consider hospice. The other thing that happens on hospice is that people actually live longer and they live better. And sometimes they live so much better that they stop dying. So it's not always a death sentence. Sometimes you get such good support and care, you actually get better. So it's worth it to at least consider it and be informed.
Right. And I think that, you know, the parallel between bringing life into the world and watching life leave is so, it's a beautiful parallel, actually, when you think about it, how similar they really are, you know, the way that they happen and the process and the circle of life is just such an interesting, well, for me, I think that it's an interesting journey, you know, totally.
Yeah.
And,
I agree.
You know, it's nothing to be afraid of because I always tell people that dying is just another part of living. It's just the end of living. you know, and it's the completion of the circle. And you're coming back to the starting point again from the other side or the other end. So for me, I'm not really afraid of it. I want to make sure that I left nothing undone. I don't want any unfinished business, let's put it that way. And I always tell people, you know, make a list of your things. You know, some people call it the bucket list or whatever, but see what you've accomplished that you wanted to in your life. And, you know, I always tell people I need to either make up a new list or I can say if I go tomorrow that I've accomplished everything that I wanted to. I choose to update my list a little bit. But, you know, it's an interesting process, and I'm so glad that you came on today to talk to us about this, because we have about 3 minutes left in our show, and it's been such an enlightening and enriching show. And, again, we have been speaking with Ms. Vicki Kine, and the name of her book is The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. And, you know, people, pick up a copy of this book. It can be your guide through that dark moment. And trust me, it's full of information that you can really use. And again, Ms. Kine, I'm so thankful that you believed enough in healing through her to come on here and talk about this very passionate subject with us. And, you know, I would like to say that next time I speak with you, it'll be on a different term, but I may be calling on you from time to time if listeners have questions that they want to pass through me to you, or even if I have questions, I'd love to keep in touch and do that. But thank you so much for joining us here on Healing Through Hurt this evening. This has been such a wonderful, wonderful show, and don't be surprised if I call you back so that we can pick up and continue this thing.
It would be great. I would love that. I just think your heart and your message and your journey is so beautiful, and I'm just honored to be on your show. Thank you for the great
thank
work
you
you're
so
doing.
Much. Thank you so much, and thank you for writing such a great book, and I'll be in touch really soon, but thank you for joining us here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio.
Bye. Thanks.
Thank you. Good night. Again, we have been speaking with Ms. Vicki Kine, the author of The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't. This is Maria Wall. I'll see you back here in 2 weeks. I'm going to take off next week for some me time, but I want to thank you again for joining me here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I am your host, Maria Wall, and I will see you back here in 2 weeks.
Thank you for joining us here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. As always, we'd like to remind you that the views, statements, and or comments of show guests, callers, or hosts do not necessarily reflect the views or beliefs of the Wall Foundation Incorporated or Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. These comments are those of our guests, callers, and hosts alone. Therefore, the Wall Foundation Incorporated and or Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio is not party to nor liable for resolution of issues between show guests, callers, hosts, and or listeners. I want to thank you again for joining us here at Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I'm your host, Maria Wall, and I look forward to seeing you back here next week when we'll bring you more real people, real stories, real hurt, and real healing. Until then, be well.
Again, this is Maria Wall. I want to thank you all for joining us here this evening on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I will see you back here in 2 weeks. I'm going to take some me time next week, and we check back on our website and see who our guests will be week after next. Until then, you be well, take care, have a wonderful week. See you in 2 weeks.